station from around the nation. It's the 411. We're sharing a cave. What a way to make your day. Sharing K is on the way. It's the 411. We're sharing a cave. It's about newsmakers, movers and shakers, inspiration from around the nation.
This is Will Downing reminding you that knowledge is power. And that's why when I'm in Nashville, I don't miss Sharon Kay with What's the 411 on 88.1 FM, WFSK, from historic Fisk University.
You need to stop right now, Will. You just need to stop. Hello, Nashville, and all the truly wonderful people who are gathered online, on the phone, in the car, in the Bluetooth, in the whatever by any means necessary, at your desk, listening, wherever you are, stuck in traffic, you know you are in Nashville for sure. So happy to have you with us this afternoon. On yesterday was nice to see the sun out, but we're back to looking kind of, you know, overcasty and gloomy and all that, as is going to be happening with us in the fall, this fall coming quicker than some of us are ready for. It's cold, or very cool. I won't say cold yet, but I'll say very, very cool. And daylight saving time comes to a close this weekend. We're going to miss that, and time is going to change, and we're going to be, well, it's going to be dark at 4 o'clock. I mean, you know, that's a lot to dwell on. Anyway, having said that, I have forgotten that this wonderful guest is a Vanderbilt alumni. And I'm so happy to have her back on the show. And that is Cheryl Cashin. She is the Carmike Waterhouse Professor of Law, Civil Rights, and Social Justice with Georgetown Law. Hey, Professor, how are you?
Hello, Miss Cher. It's so good to be back with you. And more importantly, I'm the daughter of two Fiskites.
Oh, Lord. Now, see, this is too much, God. You are just too much, Lord. You are the daughter. The daughter. Oh, wow. Who's mom and dad?
Dr. John Cashin and Joan Carpenter Cashin, they're both deceased, but, you know, I have a memoir about my father coming of age on Fisk's campus. It's called The Agitator's Daughter.
Wow.
And there's a little Cashin Theater on campus that was my great aunt, my father's aunt, Aunt Jack, who was chair of the English department for 30 years. It's named after her.
Oh, really? So the little the little theater over there.
The little theater.
Yeah,
you go look at the plaque. It's named after Lillian Cashin, who was my father's aunt.
Well, no. Now, see, you all just don't realize how teeny tiny and small the world really is, because this is just more than I expected. Because last time I knew that you were alum, a Vanderbilt alum, but you are like ever on the altar times 10. You got your parents and your uncle and aunt. I'm like, Lord, this woman is so awesome. Well, we're happy to have you with us today.
Thank you so much.
Now, Cheryl, aren't you originally from Alabama?
Huntsville, Alabama. Okay. Right down the road. All right. And I'll say, I went to Vanderbilt on a full merit scholarship. And I took that deal, but I did cross register and I took some courses at Fisk while I was there.
Okay. Oh, so you a daughter of the ever on the altar too then. Okay.
Right.
Well, do you ever come back?
I was on the Vanderbilt board for a decade and came back a lot, but but I haven't been there since the pandemic. I'm not up on board anymore.
Okay.
But I promise I have actually some things to donate to the Fisk Library for my father's papers. So I promise next time I'm in town, I will be there.
You better come by and see me.
I will.
I can look out my window right now over at the library. I can see the John Hope and Aretha Franklin Library right out my window. Mm-hmm. That's how that's how close we are to them. And I just, you know, love and appreciate them over there because they are just wonderful people and they listen to the station. So that makes them 20 times better. Now, Cheryl, you were with me a couple years ago on the show for another book that you had written, and you are back with a new one, White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity, Hoarding, and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. And wow, that's a lot. Just the title alone says a lot generationally to people. Is that what you had at least hoped the title would do before they even get the book?
Right. Well, the title, 90% of selling the books is getting the right title. And I'm sure all of your listeners can relate to White Space, Black Hood. You know, my book is about the fact that we have a caste system based on where you live. And it was designed to subordinate black people. And, you know, starting with the 20s and 30s, I'm hearing an echo of my voice if the tech people can do anything about it. But anyway, wherever black people lived or moved to, beginning in the 10s, 20s, 30s, you know, you had lots of great migrants escaping, trying to escape Jim Crow and moving north and west, but it happened in Nashville too.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government marked black neighborhoods as hazardous and redlined them. You know, in Nashville, Green Hills, Belle Meade, they got an A rating, right? The cities, the areas east, north, and west, southeast of downtown, black areas, half of the city, all got a D rating, hazardous. And that's in the 30s. And it marked black neighborhoods as not worthy of investment, not worthy of traditional mortgages. And that explains why we have, to this day, a serious wealth gap. You know, for every dollar of white wealth, black Americans have 8 cents. And there's a huge homeownership gap. You know, in Nashville, only 43% of blacks own their home compared to 72% of whites. And all of it has to do with these cumulative blunt force trauma, negative policies visited on black neighbors. So you get redlining, then you get Negro removal, urban renewal, a lot of black homes displaced. The people who were displaced had to be put somewhere, and usually government intensely put them in segregated public housing projects, creating iconic black ghettos that people would avoid. And then you get the interstate. Look at where the interstate is laid, in Nashville, in Atlanta, in almost every major city. Typically, it was intentionally laid to wall off the black side of town from everywhere else. And so we have a system in this country where we overinvest and exclude in affluent white areas, and we disinvest, contain, and frankly prey on people in high poverty black neighborhoods, and then we tell the stories about people in the hood to justify the way things are. So the title speaks to that.
Now, where does the gentrification that we're seeing all over the place come into that picture, and is that part of what you cover in your book? Because that certainly is putting doing a reverse. The hot properties are the ones where the black people were kind of forced to live, and that's what they're gobbling up now and moving
because
the black
cheaper.
Folks. Oh, okay.
Right. Right, but see, but why were black homes cheaper. Okay, of course, gentrifiers are going to go and move to where they can afford or where they can buy something cheap and develop it and flip it and sell it for more, right? But we have all these policies I described in which government has taught lenders, investors to devalue black neighborhoods. And so they're a lot of them are depressed, they're cheaper, and they a lot of them have been preyed on with subprime loans. So there were, during the housing crisis, the last housing crisis, there were a lot of foreclosed homes in black areas. And so, you know, and then what you do is you have speculators coming in and buying up those foreclosed properties that a lot of black families lost and selling them to other people. So that's why, you know, cities have become popular again, and so people want to live there, and everybody's been priced out of the high opportunity white areas. So young people especially are coming out of schools with a lot of debt. Where do they do? They look around and say, what can I afford?
Yeah.
And that's putting gentrification pressure on black neighborhoods.
X, I know you had something you wanted to jump in right quick and say.
She said something that really struck a chord with me. I was watching Joy Reid the other day, and she had Representative Cori Bush on with her, and they were talking about the Build Back Better. And the two of them articulated exactly what the two of you and Sharon are talking about, and Cori Bush hit the nail on the head in ways that I had never heard of before, and so did Joy Reid when she talked about the Build Back Better and why she's holding out as a progressive member of the Democratic Party. And Senator Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema wanted to sort of steamroll past them, but she was saying, no, the things that the people I'm standing up for are the exact same people that you and Sharon are talking about, the people in some of these urban communities, the black communities, the Hispanic communities that would have otherwise been left behind if they went ahead and did the bipartisan infrastructure bill and then left to the side to sort of linger, would have been exactly what you were talking about, these communities that have been left out and marginalized and schemed upon and redlined and everything else. And so I just wanted to say, hey, y'all are right on point.
Right. So I identified three anti-black processes that create residential caste. One is just boundary maintenance. You know, we still have a lot of policies where government invests in and maintains exclusion. Y'all know where the boundaries are in Nashville. I don't have to tell you about them, but they're intentional. And we don't invest in policies that encourage inclusion. You know, we encourage separation and displacement. And then there's the opportunity hoarding. Even in black-run cities, I featured Baltimore in an entire chapter where blacks have been mayor, like 6-7 mayors in a row, actually more than that, and then a majority of black representation on the city council. They discovered when they actually did an equity analysis that they were spending 4 times as much in white neighborhoods as black neighborhoods in that city, right? They were shocked, right? And they, so, you know, now they have an equity analysis so that traditionally defunded black neighborhoods are getting now a fairer share of community development dollars. And I guarantee you, Nashville probably has the same patterns. They exist everywhere. And then the third anti-black process we have surveillance, particularly in, you know, surveillance of black bodies. Black bodies who can go into to high opportunity white spaces. People who feel uncomfortable with that, they'll call the police for no reason, mm-hmm. right? But then you also, in high poverty black neighborhoods, they basically live in a police state mm-hmm. where police view every young man they see as they presume that they're thugs, mm-hmm. right? You know, you can get stopped, frisked, arrested for very ordinary behavior, mm-hmm. right? So when it comes to coming back to Build Back Better, I totally agree. There's a Fed study I cite which shows that all of the black neighborhoods that were marked as hazardous 8-9 decades ago it correlates to this day with disinvestment. And I argue that any new infrastructure dollars that get allocated, historically defunded black neighborhoods should get priority for those investments.
Now, as I can remember from years gone by, those neighborhoods were also the ones where they would put the dump and they would put things that mainstream America didn't want to deal with, like we had here in Nashville in the Bordeaux area, and it took decades to get that body closed down. And how has that impacted those areas? Because that's some of the section of Nashville now where the growth is going. And is that going to bring about a different phase or change to what it is that you're discussing in your book?
Well, so high poverty areas, black areas, got the worst of everything. So they got disinvestment.
Yeah.
But to this day, there tends to be a life expectancy difference of as much as 20 years.
Right.
For residents of poor areas, because they're exposed to lead, they're exposed to toxins, they're exposed to gun violence. There's a shortage of healthy food. You know, hard to get transportation to get to jobs. And there's a lot of stress, right? Just daily stress of living, particularly in a situation where police prey on you. So, yes, and then you mentioned environmental justice. They're more likely to be near a toxic site than any other neighborhood.
So how does that figure into this whole discussion in your book? Because if those places were deemed unhealthy because of the environmental impact it was having on the community of color, white people are certainly not going to want to put their golf course on it and their $500,000 home on it. So can you, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about that. Because that's also another, those are also considered as hotspot areas too. When a city is growing leaps and bounds like this one is out of control. It really is. It's just going growth crazy. And our infrastructure is in no way ready for this volume either. If you have a question or comment, I'm so happy to have Professor of Law, Civil Rights, and Justice with me. And she is, Cheryl Cashin is back. And of Georgetown University. She has a new book, and I would urge you to read it. White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding. Something to think about. Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Equality. If you have a question or comment, it's 615-329-8810. Let's take the time out, and we'll be right back.
Listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810. 329-8810.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Good afternoon. Still moving right along on 65 up towards Goodlettsville. Just busy on the South Loop, the West Loop. Give yourself a little bit of extra time. There's a crash there at Dr. D.B. Todd Jr. Boulevard at Jackson Street. This traffic report brought to you by Princess Hot Chicken. I'm Commander Chuck. You're on time traffic.
Support for WFSK comes from the First Art Museum, now presenting Mary Sabande, Blue, Purple, Red, through January 2nd. In this exhibition, artist Mary Sabande confronts the racial, gendered, political, and economic inequities in South Africa through her hyper-realistic sculptures and photographs that prominently feature powerful black women. Come experience these stunning and emotional narratives of resignation, hope, and anger. The First Art Museum is open Thursdays through Sundays and is located at 919 Broadway in downtown Nashville. Learn more at firstartmuseum.org. Support for WFSK comes from the Global Education Center, presenting a year-long Black Arts in America project. On November 6th, that is this Saturday, the Global Education Center welcomes the family band The Settles Connection for a concert of all things Americana, touching on folk, traditional, and gospel music. The band was formed by Odessa Settles as a way to honor the band's father's contribution to America's traditional performance art culture. Walter J. Settles' legacy includes being a former member of the Grammy-winning Fairfield Four. The concert will be at 7 p.m. at the Global Education Center on Charlotte Avenue. Tickets are $15 and available on the center's website at globaleducationcenter.org. Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, in Nashville, Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And this afternoon, I'm happy to have this half hour the author of the book White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality, Professor Cheryl Cashin. And Cheryl, you are just bringing it on in, sister. And I already see right now, this is not enough time. I don't know what I was thinking about. I'm like, Lord, this doesn't need more time here. Because we have so very much to talk about. I haven't even really cracked open the book, because you are so on point. But before the break, I was asking you about these neighborhoods, in particular like Bordeaux and other places here in the city. You know, the railroad tracks and the dump and the electrical grids are bad and this and that. But suddenly those become the new hot spots of Nashville, where they want to build, you know, life and easy breezy on the riverfront. And, you know, it used to be a dump, and now so it's so amazing how that concept has got people thinking totally different about areas that you couldn't even get anybody to even look your way before. And now they're the new hotspots.
Yeah, well, it's a sad commentary, right? We have a history of devaluing mm-hmm. black spaces and then overvaluing white spaces. And so when white people move in, then suddenly those areas are worthy of stratospheric investment, right? And so I shine a light on that. And in the final chapter, I call for abolition and repair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I invoke a great former Fisk professor, W.E.B. Du Bois, right? But he argues is that we need to tear down systems that oppress black people and replace them with systems that lift people up. And we also need to bring allies, right? You need to create your abolition democracy. But the beauty of it, once you understand what's going on and how geography alters politics, such that we're overinvesting in whiteness and disinvesting in blackness. Once you have a majority, a political majority that understands that, the beauty is you just do the opposite of what you've been doing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So you need to greenline black neighborhoods rather than redline them, invest in them. You do need to deal with gentrification specifically. Mm-hmm. There needs to be some trusted community institutions, trusted, frankly, Black-led community institutions that collectively own some housing, that you know, rental housing, so that we're always sure that there's going to be a fair share of rental housing that Black people can live in, low-income people can live in, while areas are being made nicer. And then you also need inclusion rather than segregation, and you need equitable public funding. A number of cities, Baltimore, Seattle, Minneapolis, now have racial equity required in their budgeting. Every year, they look and see actually where the dollars have been going and try to reallocate to neighborhoods that haven't been getting their fair share. And then, you know, you need humanization and care rather than surveillance of people. And, you know, what I say is the beauty is once you can change the lens in which you see Black people from presumed thug to presumed citizen, it frees you up to focus on evidence-based strategies that actually work to uplift people and cost less. So, you know, I have a lot of examples, you know, from like making bus routes from the poorest neighborhoods free, to giving young men who are involved with gun violence peacemaker fellowships that help them transform their lives. And these are things that cities are actually doing. You know, universal basic income pilots for the very poor people, right? There are things we can do, abolition and repair, today, while we're, you know, dealing with the larger problems of, you know, how we build a more inclusive city where everybody gets to live.
Now, Cheryl, I was real clear that I said I didn't give this, because this is one of those topics, you know, that I'm going to have to, I hate that my time is up, but you and I can communicate, because I think I have your email, so I'm going to get you back on, because this is so going on here, and discussed, in this very neighborhood I'm sitting in right now, so I want to circle back with you and to have this conversation about this very, very important topic as it relates to where we are today, not just nationally, but in this neighborhood where I sit. So I just really, really appreciate so much the opportunity to reconnect with you and to hear about your latest book. And are you about to go on book tour?
I'm on it now, yeah. So, I mean, I'm almost every day, virtually, for the most part, doing interviews. And I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be back in touch with you and on the air.
Oh,
it's a great honor.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. Now, see, that's love, y'all. I'm just saying, you know, because I'm like, this is she got so much going on in her schedule right now. She don't have time for me, and I thank you so much.
It's an honor.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to circle back with you probably in a day or so and give you some potential dates and times that are more convenient for you as well as for me. And we have to have more than time than this in case I want to have some people that call, you know, I might have some questions and things for you, okay?
Okay.
Now, tell us where your work is and on your books, etc. Best place.
So you can find my book wherever it's sold. You can also go to my website, CherylCashin.com, and there's lots of buttons to push to order it online. You know, you could visit bookstores physically as well.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate your support.
Absolutely. And we will be with you soon, and thank you very much. It's so good to hear you, okay?
Thank you so much, Miss Sharon.
All right, you have a good rest of the day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Man, that was nice. I'm just so happy to talk with her because that's been a couple of years. You know, sometimes folks get all up in their stuff and they forget who you are. Just precious. Anyway, now it's time to move on to another book, another topic. The marathon don't stop. Oh no, it does not stop. The life and times of Nipsey Hussle. And I am happy to welcome in on this half hour the author of the new book, Rob Kenner. Hey Rob, how are you?
I am well and blessed and highly favored. It's nice to be speaking with you today.
Oh, you're so good. Now, y'all keep telling me that stuff, okay? Make me want to continue to be on the air. I mean, it's just, I love good energy. You know, I have it, and I like to receive it sometime. Anyway, are you so far so good, having a good day?
Having an excellent day. I'm riding through the streets of Manhattan right now. I just came from a meeting at Grand Central Station with one of my friends at Vibe back in the day.
Yeah.
You might know I was one of the founding editors of Quincy Jones' hip-hop magazine.
Yeah, I remember that magazine well. And Quincy Jones, you know, that's the man. And
already know, that's the dude. You know, you don't have to say too much more.
I'm from the old school when Quincy Jones was young, okay? So, you know, before he got to be the granddaddy thing that he is now, yeah. And
the OG.
Yes, honey, and he was just, oh, wow. And still is. And, you know, one of the things I admire about him is his ability to stay inside of every generation. Does that make sense?
100%. That's why he started Vibe. He saw the parallel between the bebop cast that he was a part of and the hip-hop generation. He said, oh, no, we got to do the right thing by these young men. And, you know, he has remained in step. I don't even count numbers with myself or Q, but he's right in step with today, 2021. So.
Yeah. Now, he's the real Q, y'all, not that conspiracy theory group. This is the original Q.
No.
This is the Quincy Q. Quincy Jones. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Say it loud.
Quincy Jones, the music master, maestro, the composer, the bomb man. He's the jazz man. Okay, that one. And
let's also mention a little record called Thriller.
Oh, yeah.
You might have heard of that one.
I might have made a hit playing it in my DJing days, man.
Exactly.
Oh, yes. Now, Quincy Jones, you know, you're just in a blessed spot. Rob, you're in the blessed spot to be able to have work with him.
That's how I feel.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. Yeah, it was more than a blessing to be chosen to take part in his vision of bringing hip-hop to the world, you know. And when we started Vibe Magazine in 1992, mm-hmm. everybody thought it was crazy. Like, what are you doing? A hip-hop magazine with long articles and beautiful photographs of these young men, like, and women, you know, who's going to read these articles, they used to say. You know, everybody had all these misconceptions, but Quincy understood how important this culture was, you know. And without forgetting about why we're on this call, we're talking about Nipsey Hussle, but it was at Vibe that I first met Nipsey Hussle. I never heard of him.
Oh, wow.
But he came up to the offices of Vibe in 2009, very early in his journey as an artist, and he wanted to play his mixtape for us, you know, and by this time, we had done, you know, the first profile of Puff Daddy, the first cover on Snoop Dogg, the first, you name it, a lot of important artists got their first light in the pages of Vibe, so Nipsey understood that, he was a student of the game, and he said, I need a page in Vibe, so he was sending his demo, and I learned later while I was researching the book, The Marathon Don't Stop, he was getting a little salty that we weren't getting back to him. You know, we received a lot of submissions. We didn't know about him yet. But when he just stayed determined, like everything else that Nipsey Hussle set his mind to, he just stayed with it until he accomplished his goal. And by God, in 2009, late in 2009, he came up to our office, played his mixtape, and I was blown away.
Well, it's interesting that he would be so moved by, you know, Quincy is a legend, you know, a totally different generation, might seem like a real old man or OG or whatever, and, you know, but he still aspired to be, Nipsey still aspired to be in that magazine. That wasn't because of who Quincy Jones was and what the magazine represented.
I think he understood that Vibe was taking hip-hop to another level.
Uh-huh.
And Nip Hustle loved hip-hop so much. Like, from a young age, he wanted to be a rap star. You know, he loved Criss Cross and Lil Bow Wow. He wanted to be like a child rap star. You know, he had this ambition in mind from very early.
Mm-hmm.
Because he saw a road from where he was at and his family were at in their life in South Los Angeles in the late 80s, early 90s,
mm-hmm.
he saw a pathway to a better place.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed that hip-hop was the ticket to that. So, you know, he wanted anything to accomplish that goal. And Vibe was a step on that path mm-hmm. to where he wanted to be.
Most
you know, so he made, yeah, he set his intention. And he stayed with it, and when he came to the office, everyone in that room remembers meeting Nipsey Hussle, and we had never heard of him in our life, but he was so impressive, his demeanor, his presentation, his charisma, and the music. You know, when he pressed play on that tape, that was a powerful piece of work he put out, you know? And this is way before his major label albums, and this is a mixtape from the streets of L.A., but it just impressed us so much, the truth of what he was saying. And I said to him that day, I remember I spoke to him after he played his music, and I said, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. We're going to support you any way we can. We're going to keep listening. And he got his pay. We ended up writing him up in Vibe Magazine, 2009.
Wow.
And, you know, he went on to do a lot of much greater things. Vibe soon actually ceased publication because, to be honest with you, Nipsey Hussle had a better digital and internet strategy than we did at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he continued to rise, and I paid attention to him as we continued our journey. And, you know, 10 years later, we met again when he was just releasing his first major label album after, you know, a good dozen mixtapes.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation that we had that day led directly to this book, Marathon Don't Stop.
Well, you know, your career, Rob, has been a total gas, man. You have had so much fun. I know you have. Okay, I already know you have because of those experiences that you're talking about and the people that you have had the opportunity to write about, to work with, and just to meet. I need to take a time out so we can get our traffic report. So hold on one second, okay?
Cool. All right, I'm here.
All right, now, this book is entitled The Marathon Don't Stop, y'all. It just does not. And I'm happy to have the author of the new book, Rob Kenner, on with me this afternoon. And, of course, this is about the life and times of Nipsey Hussle. Let's take a time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Good afternoon. Watch the traffic increase even more now on the South Loop, the West Loop. It's building also on 65 down through Brentwood, Franklin, stacked up right on schedule 65 at Metro Center there at Rosa Parks, and starting to develop heavy traffic outbound on Ellington Parkway. This traffic report brought to you by Ripley's Aquarium in the Smokies. I'm Commander Chuck with your on-time traffic.
Support for WFSK comes from the Frist Art Museum, now presenting Mary Sabande, Blue, Purple, Red, through January 2nd. In this exhibition, artist Mary Sabande confronts the racial, gendered, political, and economic inequities in South Africa through her hyper-realistic sculptures and photographs that prominently feature powerful Black women. Come experience these stunning and emotional narratives of resignation, hope, and anger. The Frist Art Museum is open Thursdays through Sundays and is located at 919 Broadway in downtown Nashville. Learn more at fristartmuseum.org. Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, in Nashville, Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. We thank you so very much for supporting What's the 411. The marathon don't stop, y'all. The Life and Times of Nipsey Hussle is this half hour's book, and I'm happy to have Rob Kinner on. And Rob is one of the most prolific and influential voices in hip-hop publishing. He's a founding editor of Vibe, and I know many of you remember Vibe magazine. Kinner joined the startup team of Quincy Jones's groundbreaking Hip Hop Monthly in 1992, and during a 19-year run at Vibe, he edited and wrote cover and feature stories on iconic cultural figures that, of course, range from Tupac to Barack Obama, as well as writing the acclaimed column Boom Shots. So we are happy to have you with us today to discuss your new book. And I can tell that you really, truly, Ken, had respect for Nipsey's hustle. You really were into what was the lifestyle. You had a better understanding because you had relationships and interviewed a lot of these people. So you probably saw things from a very different perspective, right?
No question about it. I think he's one of the most misunderstood and important figures in hip-hop history. And pardon me, there's a truck driving by. I'm on the street of New York City right now, speaking to you in Nashville, and so happy to be talking with your audience today. Nipsey is, to me, he's the ultimate fulfillment of what hip-hop is supposed to be. It's more than putting out records and music videos. It's about self-empowerment. It's about speaking truth to power. It's about bringing up yourself, your family, and your whole community. And nobody ever did that more than this young man. And that's why I thought his story was very important to tell. And, you know, I wrote this book over the past 3 years, and it's one of the most challenging and rewarding projects I've ever taken on.
Now, let me ask this, because, you know, people are still, they still talk about, you know, Tupac and his influence and others and their influence. So how do you see, as Nipsey's influence is, and as you are describing him, what are the different characteristics that he brings to the table that others have not?
Well, Nip himself said, "I'm the Tupac of my generation." So he idolized Tupac and many of these other figures that you mentioned. You know, he was a lover of hip-hop first and foremost. He loved anyone that could use beats and rhymes to lift their people up. But what was different between, let's say, Tupac and Nip is that Nip lived a little bit longer. You know, he was able to put the ideas and the intentions into practice. You know, there's a famous interview where Tupac Shakur says, "I might not change the world, but I guarantee I will spark the brain of the one who does." And I think one of those individuals was definitely Aramis Askedome, who we know now as Nipsey Hussle. So what Nipsey did was to build not only a successful independent label, as some others have done, but he also reinvested all the profits of that label into his direct neighborhood, the same neighborhood where he was selling homemade mixtapes in the parking lot. He and his brother, Black Sam, they purchased that whole strip mall and then opened multiple businesses. And this is all through very positive, productive, you know, above the board business. I'm talking about shared workspace, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics learning center. I'm talking about, you know, healthy restaurants, all types of businesses which were providing gainful employment in an area with very few opportunities. And it all started from the hip-hop music and also the merchandise and, you know, the Marathon clothing brand, which many people now are still proudly wearing. You know, he built something that will last for a very, very long time. And, you know, that's what sets him apart from other people who had the intention to do that. You know, there's a lot of very, you know, hip-hop is filled with self-made moguls and rags-to-riches stories. But there are few who stayed in their community and built it up. You know, a lot of times you get successful and you move away. That was a Nipsey Hussle's way. And, you know, he and his brother Black Sam stayed 10 toes down, as they like to put it, right there in the heart of South Central. And, you know, a lot of people consider, you know, N.W.A. and Dr. Dre and, you know, Snoop Dogg as like Los Angeles rap. One of the things that needs to be clarified is that Los Angeles is a county with, you know, Compton, Long Beach, various other, you know, sections. But when you talk about Los Angeles as a city and South Central at the heart where, you know, the Rodney King uprising took place, like in the crossroads, there has not been a major hip-hop star who was able to live and thrive in the heart of L.A. Hmm. Nipsey Hussle is that one of one.
Well, and so in his life and times, as you so well cover in the book, what was it in his growing up, or was it just the spirit of hustling that gave him the drive? Because, you know, everybody that you talked about has a drive, but in a different direction. He had a talent and an entrepreneur flair, and didn't just think one dimensional about his entrepreneur village he was building.
No question about it. I think there's a combination of factors. One of the most important is that his father, Dawit Askedome, was a freedom fighter from Eritrea in East Africa. And when he came to America and, you know, fell in love with Nip's mom and, you know, had these two sons, it was a piece of African culture right in Los Angeles. And so his sons had the opportunity to travel back home to Eritrea with him at a formative age. There was a very important trip that took place when they were in their teen years, and I think that had a profound impact on just expanding both of these young men's horizons and understanding, you know, a world exists beyond the neighborhood where we grew up. And also, I think Nip's older brother, Black Sam, Samil Askedome, is a very important piece of all of this. He's a gifted entrepreneur, just a retail genius beyond compare. You know, the things he was doing, his gift isn't making music. His gift is like setting up a card table in a parking lot and selling whatever the neighborhood needs, whether it's socks, t-shirts, DVDs, CDs, what have you. He found a way to stretch a nickel into a dime, into a dollar, and just stacking and building until they could, you know, they would have harassment from the police, have all their stuff confiscated, and finally, you know, one of the cops that was bothering them said, why don't you get a store and pay taxes like everybody else? So at that very moment, they saw a for rent sign and went ahead and rented a space. And that was what built up till they could actually purchase the entire strip mall. You know, and that's one of the most beautiful things about this story is that they did it all just from the curb up and managed to establish a foothold in a neighborhood where so few people of color actually own the real estate, right. You know?
Right.
And, you know, they showed that that could be done and provided legitimate employment for so many people that might have been doing things that would get them in trouble and cause problems in the community. Instead, Sam and Nipsey provided another way. And that's the story that, you know, I really wanted to tell in The Marathon Don't Stop.
And I guess that's why the news of his death and a couple of years ago in 19, it just, you know, it shook so many that were influenced by him in different ways. Where I know in the book you discussed that, his fan base and the death and everything. Tell us about that section of the book, Rob.
Well, as you know, the book began before the tragedy of March 31st, 2019. And, you know, that was never the focus or, you know, the reason to do a book. But, of course, it is a part of the story. So, you know, the book actually opens at the memorial service at the Staples Center when, you know, everyone is paying tribute to this heroic figure who was taken away too soon. And I don't know why the good people in life are taken away so early sometimes, but it seems to be a recurring pattern. You know, we've seen it all too many times. But, you know, here we are now in 2021. The trial of the accused, you know, gunman has still not taken place. They're saying it might happen next year sometime. I don't know if anybody can understand why someone would do that, you know? There's no logical explanation to take a person who was a pure force of good out of a community where there were very few reasons to have hope and inspiration, you know? But it's something that it defies explanation, and you never really get over a loss like that. But, you know, the phrase, the marathon continues, is you know, ringing out on the internet and through the music. Actually, November 1st, 2011 was the release date of that mixtape. And so we're speaking just a couple of days after the 10th anniversary of the Marathon Continues mixtape being released. And, you know, that was an inspirational moment in itself, you know. You know, when he did that mixtape, he had chosen to step away from a management team and a major label that, you know, he didn't fully align with, and he wanted to take it in a new direction, and it was a leap of faith for him. So here we are now, people are trying to continue Nipsey's marathon. You know, his family is doing it, his big brother, a lot of the artists that were affiliated with him. I'm talking about some of his mentors early on, people like Cuzzy Capone, people like Cobby Supreme, a lot of the younger artists that he brought to, you know, have a situation with his label, All Money In. They're all making music inspired by him and So the marathon definitely does continue. We see murals of Nipsey Hussle all over the world, whether in Los Angeles, New York City, Atlanta, Africa, they're everywhere. And, you know, that's because he touched people's hearts in a very powerful way. And, you know, I've been very humbled by the response to the book, Marathon Don't Stop. People have embraced the book. I've received DMs from everyone in every part of the world, and, you know, people going through difficult times reading this book, telling me they shed tears reading the book. And it's a very humbling thing for a writer. All we want is to tell the stories that inspire us, and we hope that it will touch somebody. And I'm happy to be speaking to you today. I hope folks in Nashville that haven't tapped into Nip, you know, one of the things about him that's so amazing is that he stayed under the radar. As much as people love him, he didn't sign to a major label until very late in his career. He didn't want to take a deal that was going to exploit his creativity. He understood the game on another level, and so he just wanted to connect with his fans using technology and social media. This is someone that built computers from parts when he was in high school, and he was a genius level brain.
Yeah.
And he understood technology so well that he just said, I don't need a record label. I can connect to my fans, you know, give them my music. Mm-hmm. When it's time, I'll ask them to support. Mm-hmm. He put up a CD for $100. Mm. When no one was buying music, there was no, you know, music was downloaded for free. He said, please support this project, $100 a CD. They sold 100,000 in one day,
wow.
You know? And that's just the kind of mind that he had, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, Nip was on another level, and people are still kind of catching up. Like, the ideas that, like, that particular thing of marketing a CD for a high price and then bundling it with, like, a live show ticket and stuff like that. The music industry has now taken that idea that Nip innovated, and artists like Justin Bieber and Taylor Swift use it as part of their rollout every year now. You know, it's just, he was another level.
So they're cashing in on the concept. What a
basically, crazy. Yeah. And, you know, wow. It's all there. It's like the game is to be sold and not told. But, you know, one of the things that Nip said in my last conversation with him, and why I really knew I had to write a book or make a film or do something more than what we intended originally with the interview. He said, you know, I'm not outside giving out bags of money, but the game is free. And when we were youngsters coming up, that's all we expected the OGs to do was give us a game.
Yeah.
You don't have to tell us all your secrets, but just give us a little inspiration, a little insight that we can follow in your footsteps.
Yeah.
And my effort in this book was just to pass on some of the game that Nip shared with me so that more people can tap in, because a lot of people didn't pay attention until after the tragedy and the Staples Center, but a lot of people that never knew about what he was doing.
Yeah, that's true. Well, then sometimes you don't get real famous until you're dead anyway. I mean, it's a shame that's the way it is. But, you know, it's like that, and that's the way it is. Oh, boy, kid. I mean, Rob, I have just really, this has been just the best conversation. And it has. I'm just not playing. You know, you have, I can tell that you love the details and the music. And, you know, you've been with Quincy Jones, so, I mean, what can I say, okay?
I got the blessing. Yeah. I mean, Q even blessed me with a quote on the book, on the back cover, so I can't even ask for more than that, you know?
Oh, yeah, man, I'm blushing like crazy, because he's the man, and just simple and pure. And I'm going to say this, and then I got to go. I remember, and, you know, I know this, the book is about the Marathon Don't Stop, the life and times of Nipsey Hussle, but I do want to say this about Quincy Jones right quick, because I do. When I was talking earlier about the fact that he weaves into every single generation, from way back up until the present, I think it was in the 90s, the early 90s, when he had the rappers on his song, on his stuff, because he had like Queen Latifah.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he was leading the way then. And
Juju,
yes, and some people in jazz, you know, were like frowning on it, but I didn't care, because you know, it was the queen, and that was that, you know. Cause,
that's it.
Yeah, that was just that.
I mean, they frowned on Miles Davis,
yes,
when he was experimenting with fusion, or
yes,
when Bob Dylan plugged in his electric guitar. You know, progress is a thing that has to happen, you know?
Yes, oh yes.
Are you aware of Quincy Jones's film platform, Quest TV?
I think for people that
are listening in,
yeah, I need to check that out. Anything he
does. QWEST.TV, and they have a lot of really dope documentaries,
okay,
and live performances on there, and there's a really good, actually Quincy said his favorite film right now is a reggae film called Studio 17,
okay,
The Lost Reggae Tapes. If y'all want to take a trip to Jamaica real quick, check that out. It's an amazing film. But yeah, anything Quincy touches is magical, and I'm so blessed to have had anything to do with anything that he did. And, you know, for him to even bless my book, The Marathon Don't Stop, with a blurb, and
I had to sit down when that
came through.
Oh, yeah, and that, you know, just a touch of that is a New York Times bestseller. I'm like, what? Oh, Lord.
Basically.
Oh, Rob, man, listen, total blessing, man. You have been just a joy, and I'm so grateful for your enthusiasm and your time today. And the book, The Marathon Don't Stop, The Life and Times of Nipsey Hussle, is available everywhere?
Yeah, that's right. I think, from what I hear, the hardcovers are almost sold out, but Barnes & Noble has them, Amazon has a few, and if your local bookstore has it, or your independent bookseller,
absolutely,
that's the most important thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do that, you all. All right, listen, have a good rest of the day, and I'll be watching for your work, okay?
All right, thank you, and I hope y'all tape recorded this interview
so
we can share it on social.
Yeah,
please send me a copy.
Yeah.
It was a really nice combo.
Oh, excellent. Now, see, I have a podcast that I'm so far behind on posting my stuff up there. I'm like, ooh, Sherry Kay. But I am, I promise, because you said it, I'm going to do it, okay?
Please do that. Please do that. Put it on your podcast or whatever.
Absolutely.
Let's get it out there.
All right. Hey,
Rob,
take care now.
Okay, you too.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, peace.
All right, that was nice. That was really nice. Okay, news coming, right? I'm past my news time, but go on and hit it.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.